This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And today we are on a journey. Call it a romp across technological landscapes that will take us from the NSA to Broadway. From digital high-tech interactivity, the stories told about us by our metadata interactions online, to the Cold War-era symbiosis of Richard Nixon and his Soviet counterpart, Leonid Brezhnev, to the low-tech but infinitely more complicated interactions and entanglements in the biological world. Technology, interactivity, and our deep interdependence as creatures, as humans. And what, you think this is some kind of time out from the news of the day, departure from current affairs? Surely you jest. This is straight from the headlines, folks, and we begin with the latest from online info villain or hero of interactivity, call him what you will, former NSA contractor Edward J. Snowden. His digital revelations about how the government can and does observe what we are all doing, their form of interactivity. Those revelations have entered yet another dimension. A new investigation by Siobhan Gorman, intelligence correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, reveals just how telecom and internet companies work with the National Security Agency in a kind of public-private alliance, conspiracy, call it what you will, to filter and exchange communications data, foreign and domestic. On this scale, perhaps foreign and domestic is an impossible distinction to make. Gorman's report comes as we learn that the so-called FISA court system that is supposed to oversee all this surveillance technology has had a rather testy relationship with the NSA regarding tens of thousands of American emails netted by the NSA between 2008 and 2011. Lots to talk about here. Siobhan Gorman, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you.
So let's talk about these complicated relationships, dare I say, symbiosis between the internet companies and the various telecom and communications companies in the private sector?
Well, it's certainly a very close relationship, but it is one forged under a court order. So the telecommunications companies don't actually have the option to say no. The way that it works is the NSA gets a very broad order from the aforementioned FISA court, presents it to a telephone company, say AT&T, which says we need to set up an arrangement. So whenever we have a particular foreign intelligence interest, you need to go through your networks, your corporate networks, and give us a stream of data through which we can look for the specific pieces of foreign intelligence that we are interested in. So the filtration looking for this foreign intelligence data has two steps. The first step is done by the telecommunications company. They provide a stream or a subset of their communications data to the NSA. Then they look through that smaller stream, which is most likely to have their information in it, and they pick out the bits that they need and they dump the rest.
Trying to figure out the due process here, as far as you understand it, if the NSA comes to me as Verizon or AT&T and says, we need this, we want to look at this, do they come armed with a FISA court approval to do this, or does the telecom company have the option of appealing that decision, saying, no, I don't want to, I want to check with a court first before they comply with the NSA?
Well, they do come armed with a court order. However, some of the government people I spoke with said, well, do remember that there are lawyers at these telephone companies, and they do at least raise questions. So the NSA has been doing this kind of surveillance in coordination with the phone companies for some years now. So they also have a little bit of a give and take. And what you do see, as far as it's been explained to me, is a different set of arrangements that is specific to each phone company. So some of the equipment, for example, that is used at one phone company might be a different set of equipment at another. And in speaking with people in private industry, we definitely have the sense that some phone companies do push back a little bit more than others.
But it's far from an actual voice of the consumer. There's nobody advocating really for individual consumers who don't want to be looked at by the government in these transactions, right?
Not so much in this process, unless the lawyer for a phone company is that person.
Let's talk about scale. What are they looking at? What do they have the capacity to see on a daily, weekly, monthly basis? And is there any way to distinguish between foreign and domestic in this scale of data surveillance, data mining?
what they've done is set up a system where, through arrangements with phone companies, the whole system has coverage over 75% of U.S. telecommunications, roughly. But that's because the individual telecommunications companies taken all together cover about that amount of communications. So the relationship provides them an indirect way to essentially query the entire system for information it's looking for. But the government officials we spoke with were very clear and very adamant that they do not reach into the phone company networks and get information. They give the phone companies the parameters of the types of information they're looking for, and then the phone company sends them these streams of data where it's difficult to calculate how much data that is. I really did try to get that. I was told, well, it's more than just the individual pieces that NSA is looking for, but it's less than everything. So it's somewhere between those two things.
All right, so let's talk about the foreign domestic distinction. This data doesn't come labeled foreign or domestic. It can have
Correct.
Various origins. How difficult
Right.
is that?
Well, it's incredibly difficult, and in fact, in our reporting, we bumped into a piece of the story that broke yesterday, which is that for a period of about 3 years or so, NSA's systems were not configured in a way that could draw a distinction between foreign and domestic communications, and when it got the domestic communications, it wasn't applying enough privacy protections, according to what the court found. So the problem is that in modern telecommunications, both foreign and domestic communications are literally physically bundled together and cannot actually be separated, and NSA's machines are programmed to take the whole bundle when they can't be separated. And so that means that then it ends up with a bunch of wholly domestic communications sitting in its databases, and the FISA court had a real problem with that.
Finally, Siobhan, how surprised were you by the intensity of, it seems anyway, of the FISA court's pushback in this interaction over technology and distinguishing domestic and foreign surveillance that was disclosed this week?
I thought it was fascinating because the judge was very strong in his wording, saying that the government was not trying hard enough to apply appropriate privacy protections to explore different technology, and in order to make sure that these wholly domestic communications were not just thrown right into NSA's databases with everything else.
Siobhan Gorman, intelligence correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Back in the good old days of the Cold War, government surveillance sounded more like this.
It's essential that those two nations, where possible, work together. And the key really is in the relationship.
No, I don't expect you to understand what's going on there. It's June 18th, 1973. Recognize that voice? Richard Nixon in the Oval Office with Leonid Brezhnev talking about working together, the U.S. and the Soviet Union. The Richard Nixon Library this week released the final set of Nixon's secret recordings, 340 hours of tape covering April through July 1973, scratchy, barely audible history for transcription. Listen to Brezhnev speaking through an interpreter. Anyway, that exchange ends with a joke where Nixon, always the politician, pumps Brezhnev, literally pumps him for political intelligence about who was more interested in detente and cooperation between the U.S. and the Soviets, Republicans or Democrats on Capitol Hill. For more on what this final set of Nixon tapes reveals about our 37th president, we turn to Luke Nichter, professor of history at Texas A&M University, Central Texas. He manages a website cataloging Nixon's secret recordings, NixonTapes.org. Professor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So this kind of closes a chapter in the whole Nixon personal surveillance saga. What does it mean to you?
Well, it's exciting because we're hearing events that happened 40 years ago, but in 2013, they're new again to us, and they're reaching a new generation, a younger generation and a digital generation.
Here's a conversation that took place on June 4th, 1973. It's a telephone conversation. There were many in the course of the Nixon presidency between Nixon and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. This is in 1973. They're, of course, talking about Nixon and his interest, obsession, visits to China.
He gets kind of look rather strange if I go running to China if he doesn't come here.
No, I've already done that. I had already extended an invitation at your suggestion a few months ago.
The Mao thing has to be significant because if it came from Shou Enlai, that'd be one thing, but coming from now.
From both. It was a joint invitation.
You know, Luke, it sounds like they're talking, you know, about a wedding. Did we get the invitation from the bride or from the bride's friend? You know, that sort of thing. The U.S. and China.
Well, you're right. You know, Nixon had just made his visit to China, the first president to do so the year before. And just 1 year later, Nixon's invited to go again to China. And we have reciprocated the invitation to invite the Chinese to the United States. And, you know, such progress had been made in Sino-U.S. relations that you just wonder what could have been possible had the presidency not been ended short.
Yeah, here's a conversation. It's actually a continuation of that same conversation where there's a lot going on behind the scenes. There's a reference to China and Cambodia. And, of course, 1973, we're right in the immediate aftermath of the worst part of the Vietnam War. Listen here.
And they also gave us a rather good message on Cambodia.
Did they?
Yes, but we mustn't refer to that in any sense.
No, because they got me get caught at it, I know.
The secrecy surrounding the Vietnam era and Cambodia, what's going on there?
Nixon and Kissinger, we just got the peace agreement signed in January of 73, but it was just with Vietnam, and it did not include the other countries in the region, Cambodia and Laos. What we're seeing is the difficulty of keeping all the partners who were part of the peace agreement together and on the same page and moving forward.
Finally, this little bit of history, it's sort of a passing of the torch. You've got Richard Nixon talking with, long before he was president, Ronald Reagan.
Ron, we have got to build peace in the world, and that's what I'm working on. And I just want you to know I so appreciate your calling and give my greatest love to Nancy. Well, how did you ever marry such a pretty girl? My God!
Well, just I'm lucky.
You're lucky. That's right. As I was lucky.
Yes, you were.
I think it's fair to say Reagan probably more lucky than Richard Nixon, as history judges it, Luke.
Yeah, this is an interesting one because Nixon had just made such a difficult speech about Vietnam on April 30th. And I think most presidents operate in a similar way. They expect to hear from supporters afterwards and see how the speech went. And here's two politicians. They're talking like friends and certainly do talk about things other than politics.
Some of the gems in the last 340 hours of tape covering April through July 1973 released by the Richard Nixon Library this week. We've been talking with Luke Nichter, professor of history at Texas A&M University, Central Texas. He manages a website cataloging Nixon's secret recordings, nixontapes.org. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Nixon left a lot of intentional electronic footprints in the Oval Office, some which he probably regretted. These days, our electronic footprints are everywhere, though. Eric called in from New York City to say he's perfectly comfortable with that.
To put it bluntly, my footprint says exactly who I am. 20 years on Wall Street, working for a nonprofit now. Anything I wouldn't want people to know, I do not post.
But from Dallas, Texas, you speak softly online. My online footprint, you write, is very, very small. I'm 26, no Facebook, Twitter, or Insta something. I use a search engine that does not keep track of my activity. But Salt Lake City, Utah, you may have a little more difficulty. It's porn, 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 bills, workouts, porn, 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 recipes, porn, 401k balance, and Facebook, they write from Salt Lake City. Coming up, an organized way for you to look at your own digital footprint. I think it's high time the rest of us got into the big data revolution, don't you think? We've had much of the year to consider what the government can learn about us by mining our so-called metadata, seeing how and exactly who we interact with online, and drawing all kinds of conclusions about the kind of people we are. As usual, the folks at the MIT Media Lab are way ahead of us on that one. Professor Cesar Hidalgo is the head of the Macro Connections Group at the MIT Media Lab. Alongside a team of two other researchers, he has created a platform for individuals to access their own metadata. It's called Immersion, and it uses your email's metadata to create a bubble map of your connections to others. I logged onto it, and poof, there was a visual picture of the various planets of people and contacts orbiting planet John Hockenberry. It was amazing, and it showed maybe even a slightly different picture of me than I see every day in the good old mirror. Cesar says that's the idea behind Immersion.
Immersion is what we like to call a big data visualization engine. This is a tool that allows people to quickly access a specific chunk of large data sets and present it in a way that is visually and easy to understand. In the case of Immersion, this big data visualization engine was designed to look at emails. And one way to think about it is to think about the big data visualization engine that the NSA would have if they wanted to quickly learn about interaction patterns of a certain individual. So what it does is it takes your email metadata, this is the from, to, CC, and timestamp of your emails, and then presents you with a visual representation in which each person is represented as a node, and links connect individuals that are likely to be CC'd in communications in which you participate. It's a tool that allows people to quickly understand the things that someone could learn if they had access to their metadata and a good visualization engine like the one that we have created.
Well, I have to say, Cesar, it's a complete mind blower to go and check out Immersion because it tells such a story about you. I mean, you immediately see who it is that you interact with a lot, who it is you interact with very little. What you say you do is very, very different from what you actually do. And when I looked at my own map, Cesar, I have no life. Everything is clustered around this radio show and all the people that are associated with communicating to put this program on the air. It's amazing to just see.
Well, you know, for me, it's obviously a similar experience. And what's interesting is that I see in the tool how my life has changed during the last 10 years. When I was a grad student, my most important nodes and cliques were groups of friends, and now they're my students and their colleagues and co-authors. So you see that transition. Now, part of it is that I think that there's a life transition that we're witnessing there. Another thing is that obviously email is the social network that we use for work. You know, there are other social networks that we use to socialize, and a lot of times when we have close interactions with people, we tend to express those interactions either face-to-face or via the phone or other media. So email is biased towards work interactions, which for me are very interesting.
But the algorithm that you use to create this visualization engine for metadata on email, you could also use in some of these other platforms, and you'd have to sort of determine what sort of level, say, texting and chatting is and Facebook news feeds are versus email, and you'd get an even more complete but instantaneous read on what people's lives are actually all about.
When it comes to the data that you describe, I like email a lot because an email interaction is an explicit act from the individual that is sending the email. Liking something on Facebook is a very low-cost type of interaction, and friending someone on Facebook also is an interaction that happens only once, and you can collect, you know, friends on Facebook as you collect Pokemons, but that does not mean that you're interacting with the person actively. When you have a collaboration with someone at work, usually that involves a lot of email volume. So although email is not usually considered a social network, it is the oldest social network. It is a web page that when you open it, you see a page that was created by other people. But it is one that requires so much effort from their users that the interactions that we get to detect through email are actually really important interactions.
Does it encourage you to be suspicious about other people when you see this data? You could certainly track the interests and communications of a mate very, very easily.
I tend to be a very optimistic person, and I tend to usually assume that people are good and everything. So, but I do think that there's some people that definitely can start using this in ways that are more suspicious than that. You know, it's not my nature, but I hear you.
But if you can get this much information from just the relatively rudimentary algorithm that you're using, I mean, imagine what some of these government organizations that have almost unlimited capability can do, right?
Yeah, so you can get more information, but the question is, would that information be relevant? I think that 99.9% of people is not worth spying, and probably more than that. We are very, very, very private about data that is really not that important. One of the things that I like about the project was that there was a lot of people that logged into their Immersion profile, and what they did is then they took a snapshot of the screen with all of the names of the people that were important, and they posted it on Twitter, and they used it as an act of expression. And they were not hiding their data, and they were not afraid of what people could learn from the data. They were curious to see what was it in that data, and they were happy to communicate it to the people that were connected to them as expressed in that data. I find that a little bit is that we are too afraid, you know, of the dark, because we don't know what can be learned from data, and we're afraid that there's a danger that we're unaware of. But I don't think that our fears are from a danger that we're really sure about what it is.
What's the most surprising thing you learned about yourself when you logged in to Immersion?
The first thing that I learned is that I was getting too distracted by exploring mostly connections that were happening on the periphery of my network, and my students, which are, you know, the core of the group that I do research with, were not as prominent as I wanted them to be. That helped me focus much more into explicitly making time to interact with them much more frequently, much more often, to create group activities, because it helped me start strategizing the way that I wanted to evolve my network. My network wasn't the network that I wanted to have, but now I had a tool that allowed me to see, well, how can I transform this network into that network and then, you know, track my progress? So I think it induced or helped catalyze a change in behavior that I was brewing.
Cesar Hidalgo is head of the Macro Connections Group at the MIT Media Lab. He headed up the Immersion team that produced this visualization engine for looking at metadata. Cesar, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks, John.
And now, once again, we hit the road in our tour of America's voting booths, 8 weeks since the Supreme Court struck down a key provision of the Voting Rights Act, making certain places more free to enact changes in voting procedures without federal approval. Last week, North Carolina became the latest to make changes when the governor signed an election law overhaul that included a voter ID requirement, a requirement that Governor Pat McCrory said last week isn't a change at all.
Photo ID has become a part of our everyday life. You need a photo ID to board an airplane, to cash a check, or even apply for most government benefits.
Mike Tomczyk is a reporter for WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. He says that what started as a simple voter ID bill in North Carolina has now become a federal case after the Supreme Court's ruling in June.
The North Carolina House passed legislation that at the time was basically a stripped-down version that was just focused on photo ID. That was really all that it did. That bill got over to the Senate, and the Senate just sat on it. The Senate waited until the Supreme Court decision and then took that bill and really built it into what it turned out as after the Supreme Court decision, which had photo ID. It took away a popular high school program that registers thousands of high school students to vote. There will be seven fewer days of early voting. And to give you some perspective, in that first week of early voting in the last presidential election, more than 900,000 North Carolinians cast ballots. That's about a fifth of the entire of all the ballots cast in the entire election. So it really went from something that was relatively focused on just photo ID before the Supreme Court decision, and then after grew into this massive elections bill.
You know, it really gives you a sense of just how much of a dampering effect the Voting Rights Act had and the preclearance rule had on any legislation of this kind. That's normally what would have happened if the Supreme Court hadn't ruled. It would have just sat in committee. It wouldn't have been deemed as terribly productive because the Department of Justice could have overruled the whole thing.
Our state attorney general even said after the Supreme Court decision, this will be a setback for voting rights in North Carolina, given our state attorney general is a Democrat and the governor and both branches of the legislature are now controlled by Republicans. But, even our state attorney general put out this clear message that, you know, this is something that will have an effect, and we are very clearly already seeing an effect.
And is this simply a matter of pent-up sort of legislative energy finding, you know, a passageway now that the Supreme Court has ruled? Or would it be completely wrong to suggest that this is a throwback, that this is a kind of a return to a pre-Voting Rights Act configuration? That wouldn't be completely correct either, would it?
Tough to say for sure. I mean, there definitely is this pent-up energy because, again, we have Republicans in control of the state legislature and the governor's mansion for the first time since Reconstruction. So, I mean, there has been this kind of sea change in North Carolina politics as the Republicans who have come into power have started to implement their policies. And, John, all of them ran on photo ID. I mean, this is something they said, if we get into power, we're going to do. They got into power. They've done it. And actually, they've gone beyond. There are all these other things that are in this elections bill that really weren't even talked about during the campaigns, but found a way in.
And so as we look forward to 2014 and then, of course, 2016, how do you think this is going to affect the campaigning, the way politicians approach candidates, the primary contests, et cetera?
My first guess is the advocates for the folks who are likely to be disproportionately impacted by this, the state chapter of the NAACP, for example, thinks that this could have a disproportionate impact on minorities. They will become very active. But the other thing is, I mean, you're likely going to see longer lines. I mean, in this past election campaign, I did a number of stories at polling sites during early voting, and there were huge lines then, and that was with a week more time.
In theory, the Department of Justice and the Voting Rights Act maintains an ability to challenge any changes that take place without the preclearance. Of course, it's a much harder road, but any chance that that's going to happen?
As we know, Eric Holder, Attorney General Eric Holder, has said that they're going to try to figure out a way to challenge a photo ID law in Texas. I certainly would not be surprised if these changes that North Carolina is trying to implement, if those get some attention from the Justice Department as well.
Michael Tomczyk, reporter at WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
Imagine me and you, I do.
Imagine me and you, I do, say the Turtles. Turtles, a band, and a species that couldn't exist without the help of other animals. Did you know that? Sea turtles depend on their good buddies, the yellow tangfish. Now, there's some low-tech, high-quality interactivity. The sea turtles protect the yellow tang, and the yellow tang provide the sea turtles with a source of tasty algae to snack on. The yellow tangfish clean those sea turtles' shells and fins right up.
You so totally rock, Squirt!
So give me some fin. Noggin.
Can't go on without you.
There are so many stories in nature of animals and plant and animal interactivity that can't live without each other. There's the very specific flower that attracts the very specific bee, a trait of nectar for pollinization. The boxer crab, Libia tessellata, carries a couple of sea anemones on its claws. The crab gets free use of tasty stingers to keep enemies at bay, while the anemones get a free ride and lots of chow from the sloppy crab's eating habits.
No, no, there's no way. No, 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 no way. I'm living without you.
Jennifer Hudson could be singing right there about the oxpecker bird who rides around on the African rhino. Oxpecker gets a slightly better deal here. There's the heartwarming story of Vibrio fischeri, the bacteria that lives inside of Euprymna scalopes, a little squid that is nocturnal but needs light to find food. The bacteria is bioluminescent, get it? Lighting up the clear squid like a set of headlights. The bacteria is protected. The squid can see in the dark. Everybody is happy.
In your arms.
But here's my favorite. The pearlfish and the lowly sea cucumber. The inedible sea cucumber has a big intestine, perfect for the nocturnal pearlfish to hide out in during the day. It comes out at night. The sea cucumber gets some rest. Pearlfish gets its breakfast. Symbiosis. Beautiful thing.
I'm keeping you forever and for always. We will be together all of our days.
Joining us now is former high school biology teacher Katie McKissick, who also blogs as Beatrice the Biologist online. Katie, welcome.
Hi there.
I just love that symbiosis story. What are your favorites?
Oh gosh, there are so many examples. It's hard, but I'm a big fan of corals and the algae that live inside of them. I like that example because sometimes people forget that corals are animals, and we think of them as plants because they need to be, you know, close to the surface of the water so they can get sunlight. But it's actually the algae that live inside of them that need the sunlight. So the corals give them this place to live, and they get all those products of photosynthesis from the algae. And the algae get this really great deal because they're all protected inside there, and they just get to do their thing.
Some of this symbiosis has, you know, kind of a commitment phobe problem. There are different levels of relationships. You've got mutualism, commensalism. Describe those a little bit briefly, if you could.
Sure. Mutualism is where it's mutual, so both sides benefit. It's also called true symbiosis, where both of them are very clearly better off because of the relationship. Commensalism is just where one side most definitely benefits, and the other side is neither helped nor hurt. It's completely neutral. An example of that would be a bird building a nest in a tree. So the bird gets this, you know, clear benefit because it has this really great location to build a nest. And the tree is obviously, you know, better off or worse off because of that.
Which would you rather be before we go, the boxer crab or the sea anemones?
I think I'd like to be a sea anemone.
Nice.
That sounds like a pretty good deal.
I'm a boxer crab myself. I like to move around. Katie McKissick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Katie McKissick is a former high school biology teacher, also known as Beatrice the Biologist, talking about symbiosis online.
Making friends.
And now, a different kind of symbiosis, and one very close to home. Humans could not have survived on this planet without some very generous assistance, and I'm not talking about friendly mastodons or trusty saber-toothed tigers and tamed wolves keeping the predators at bay during the Ice Age. Nope. It was some very humble organisms that kept us going through the rough times and are still at it. And we repay them every day by poisoning them, slaughtering our pals, scrubbing them out of our lives with an array of antibacterial sprays, soaps, and sanitizers. But the friendly, loyal germs and bacteria have one advantage. Numbers. 100 trillion bacterial cells that live with us all the time on our skin, in our mouth, and in our intestines. The power of good bacteria is a topic that Kara Miller has been exploring for her latest edition of Innovation Hub, produced by our partner WGBH in Boston. Kara, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So there's a lot of new evidence of the importance of this relationship as we live in this, hand sanitizer world.
Right, exactly. It is hard to believe, living in a modern world where something like Purell was only invented in the late 80s, and it is everywhere now. I mean, there are dispensers in hotels and in hospitals, people carrying little bottles around with them in their purses, that kind of thing, that the idea that gut bacteria could be good for you. But I have to say, one of the things, as you said, they've got on us is numbers. We're actually 90% them, bacteria, and only 10%, so to speak, us. So the idea of living in a germ-free world is pretty much never going to happen. And we've seen in the last year or so a tremendous amount of new research showing how helpful your gut bacteria can be. I actually talked with Moises Velasquez-Manoff, author of An Epidemic of Absence, and he said he worries that life in America may be getting too clean for our own good.
Some parents worry about their kids getting too many colds, and it's very bothersome, but they're also getting exposed to something that's still very mysterious, but that seems to pretty reliably protect against at least allergic disease and possibly things like type 1 diabetes. No one knows what it is yet, but it's there. And actually, I worry in these modern daycares where the caretakers put on gloves when they change the diapers, I wonder if it's too clean.
We understand that babies, when they're born, get their immune systems triggered on by getting a ton of bacteria there in the birth canal. And so that sort of begins the whole immune system process. What are the precise advantages that some of these bacteria give us that Moises Velasquez-Manoff is worried that we might be making ourselves vulnerable to by eliminating some of these helpful bacteria?
So there's a bunch of signs recently that there's a big difference between people with a really diverse gut microbiome and people without. Mm. One thing is people who actually get C-sections. You mentioned the birth canal. People who get C-sections tend to have allergies more. A study out of UCLA this year showed that women who ate yogurt with bacteria, which we often call probiotics,
right,
and women who did not eat that bacteria, had a difference in how they dealt with stress. So the people who had the bacteria dealt better with stress, which indicates that there may not just be sort of a brain-gut connection, but there may be a gut-brain connection, that things go backwards, so to speak, so that your stomach actually affects your brain. We also saw a very interesting study out of Arizona State looking at kids with autism, and it turns out they have a less diverse ecosystem inside them, in their gut. This work is really, I think, on the cusp of something really big in terms of how we and the things that live inside us interact.
You live a pretty stressful life up there at WGBH. Which are you, a probiotic yogurt or what?
I don't know. It's interesting, though, because when you ask people, I asked the journalist Michael Pollan, who had his gut biome sequenced, how have you changed since you had your gut biome sequenced, since you sort of looked at the bacteria inside you? And he said one of the things that we don't realize is that one of gut bacteria's favorite foods is fiber.
One doctor said to me, he said, we're only feeding the upper GI, the upper gastrointestinal tract with this food, and we're not feeding the large intestine. So in other words, most of this really highly refined processed food is absorbed before it gets to the gut, and it doesn't leave fiber, which is really the favorite food of the microbes, much for them to eat, with the result that that community is impoverished in some ways and more prone to inflammation.
So that really explains why fiber is important. It's not really a mechanical issue. It's more a question of feeding these animals that are really helping us.
Right, exactly. And there's also these foods, not that many of them, that are in the American diet, yogurt, kimchi, sauerkraut, that actually have live cultures living in them. And we tend not to eat very much of them, but those may be also important. The other thing, the other side of this, of course, is antibiotics, which wipe out gut bacteria and, of course, sometimes are very important, but very often are used in a kind of indiscriminate way. One of the most interesting studies, I think, that really is very telling here is one that looked at the difference between Finland and a part of Russia that's right next to Finland has ethnic Finns in it. So the people are essentially the same. And the people in Russia, on the Russian side of the Finnish border, tend to have less celiac disease, fewer allergies. Here's Moises Velasquez-Manoff talking about the difference between those two groups of people.
Type 1 diabetes, which is basically Finland is the number one country in the world for type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune diabetes that usually hits in childhood. It's like one-fifth as common on the Russian side. Celiac disease, similarly not as common. Allergic diseases, meanwhile, are like one-third as prevalent.
So what's the difference there? I mean, is it diet? Is it antibiotics? What's going on?
People live closer together. There's more bacteria. The water is not as clean. I mean, Finland is a very wealthy country, and they do a lot, which is good in some ways, to keep the country clean. But it turns out there may be some downsides to living, you know, as we were talking about, in this kind of Purell society.
And, you know, it's a big surprise, right, that Michael Pollan is pro-filth in this debate here. He's all for the bacteria. I love that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it turns out that people who grew up on farms have fewer allergies than people who didn't. It seems like when you're young, being exposed to a lot of bacteria may have some real advantages.
All right, so just let those scabby knees just go unbandaged. It's
yeah,
good for the immune system.
Go out and play in the dirt today.
Kara Miller, host of WGBH's Innovation Hub. Stay filthy, won't you?
Thanks.
In our final look at low-tech interactivity this hour, in the theater these days, sometimes as a member of the audience, you're made to feel like the enemy.
Please remain seated. Please don't be so noisy.
Armed with weapons of mass disruption.
Please be quiet and courteous to others and silence your cell phones now.
But increasingly in live theater, often described as on the ropes due to alternative screen-based forms of entertainment, the audience is really getting into the act.
Well, fingers crossed.
Becoming a part of the show.
I was told there would be vodka.
Oh, good. We have the back four seats here.
Okay. Fabulous. Look at this place.
Receiving benefits way beyond that bucket of bad popcorn in a plastic chair with cup holders.
Can we order a drink? Let's get a bottle. Are they going to perform, do you think, like right in front of us?
Probably. It's huge.
Wow.
Welcome to the Theater of the Interactive. These are audience members getting ready to see the New York stage sensation Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812, where audience members are not scolded for having smartphones. They are encouraged to drink, socialize, or take part in the actual production, short of being dragged on stage. But in the interactive showbiz world, you can even get on stage in some shows. When our good pal Charlie Herman is not reporting on business and economics for Takeaway co-producer WNYC, he's what you might call a one-man stimulus program for the theater. He sees all the shows, knows it all, and we ask Charlie if theater directors are embracing this as a random fad or a real trend to meet all the small screen competition.
I think it's a trend that you're seeing an increase in these type of shows that are very immersive and you're part of it. But this has been something that's been around for a while, whether it's, you know, types of shows like Blue Man Group, where you see, you know, the guys on stage and the different things that they're doing, sort of bringing up audience members. If you go back to the 60s, there was a lot of very immersive theater. And if you take it all the way back in Shakespeare's time, you know, you had people in the pit who were interacting with the audience and what was going on. So it may not be a new thing, but there seems to be a definite upswing in the amount of programs like this.
I'm interested in how, you know, while Blue Man Group just gets an audience member up to kind of poke fun at them, with Natasha, Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812, the proximity of the audience adds to the theatrical tension.
Yeah, I mean, you are in basically a Russian supper club. You are brought in, you are seated at a table, a waiter comes up to you and will talk to you with a very strong Russian accent. It probably is an actor. You get a full meal, you have drinks, and the show happens all around you. The show is a part of War and Peace, by Tolstoy. And they're all in period costume, but they're singing very modern language, very modern songs. And, I mean, you could reach out and touch the people or fight scenes that happen next to you, and you feel very engaged with it. It's very similar to another show that just closed recently called Here Lies Love. It's a musical about Imelda Marcos, and it's music from David Byrne and Fatboy Slim, and it takes place in a disco. You are in the disco yourself because Imelda Marcos loved discos. She went to Studio 54. She reportedly had discos in the Presidential Palace. And so it's actually an integral part of the show, the fact that you were at this disco, to really understand who she was. Just say. You're allowed to sort of respond to it, to be more engaged with it. And if you think about it, that's something that we do all the time when we go to sporting events, that other big dramatic thing. We yell at players we like or we don't like. We really get engaged with it, and we feel part of it, and that's why we're so passionate about it. I think, in a way, theater recently is trying to recapture that sense.
Are people demanding this in the same way that they demand different kinds of experiences in museums, where you have a big rise in young museum-goers? Taking advantage of different kinds of experiences that in the 60s we might have called happenings.
You know, like I think so. I mean, if you look here in New York, there's been a huge amount of artistic events recently. Like at the Museum of Modern Art, there was an event called the Rain Room, where you walked into this large room where it's raining, and wherever you walked, it wasn't raining. You actually were part of the art exhibit. In Columbus Circle, there's a large statue of Christopher Columbus. They built an enormous living room around him with Christopher Columbus in the middle of it, and wallpaper and TV screens. Last year, there was an exhibit at the Park Avenue Armory called 42 Swings. Mm. Swings everywhere, and you could just go in and swing, and you were part of it. So I think there seems to be this push in the artistic community to find ways to get people to be part of it. I think it's very similar to what you're seeing online and social media, where people can interact and play more of an active role than just a passive role.
And it's different than the kind of lure them in with special effects, the Spider-Man, Take Back the Dark kind of thing, make the production values better, have stars be on stage. This is really enlarging the genre, experimenting with what theater is actually all about, and maybe getting back to what theater is all about.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when you look back at Shakespearean times, and even after that, you know, theater was often not necessarily the highfalutin kind of thing that we see now. You could have theater in bars. You could have theater in all sorts of different places. And the audience participating in the theater or reacting to what was going on was something that was not uncommon. The one professor that I spoke with, Frank Hilde, who's a professor, theater professor at the University of Maryland, he thought in 1875, when Richard Wagner turned down the lights in the auditorium for one of his operas and basically forced the audience to sit there passively and watch the show and at appropriate times clap or cheer, was really the beginning of a turn. And so what we think now perhaps is the standard. We sit there very passively, watch a theatrical production, clap, and then leave. May not actually be what was really the tradition, and we're kind of getting back into that, and it makes it more thrilling, it makes it more exciting, makes you want to go to the theater.
So if it hadn't been for Wagner, we wouldn't be being told to turn off our cell phones, to turn off our screens. It might have been just sort of allowed. Oh, there's another gadget they're bringing
in. I don't want to blame Wagner for everything, but he definitely, you know, that sort of set a precedent clearly.
So if young people are coming into the theater armed with Instagram and smartphones and you know, their impulse is to socially interact in almost any situation, and they probably do it when they go to the movies. Does theater embrace that sort of thing and come up with scripts that tries to create opportunities for people to interact online? Or does it want to go in the other direction, basically so focus people's attention that maybe that would never happen?
I think it really depends on the show. I mean, when I talked to the producer for Natasha and Pierre, his hope was that people would be so engaged with what they were seeing, so feel part of it, that they wouldn't even want to pull out their phone and interact, or they would want to be in the show and be totally immersed. I'm sure at the same time there are some producers, some directors out there right now who are thinking, what are ways that we can get people to use their phone to interact with the actors on stage, maybe to do things that could change the sets or the lights? I think it's great. If trying to find interesting ways to engage audiences, however that may be, can only be a benefit to the whole overall theatrical experience.
And theater, the history of theater is about this figuring out ways of dealing with the proliferation of media that has been going on since the very first plays were produced.
Exactly. And, you know, to tie it back to a business perspective, if they want to be viable, if they want to be able to stay alive, they have to find ways to tap into this to keep their doors open and to keep the audiences coming.
You hear him normally talking about business and economics here at WNYC, Charlie Herman on theater and the more immersive opportunities to experience theater here in New York. Thanks, Charlie.
You bet.
Our business and economics editor at co-producer WNYC. What do you think about how your online presence reflects on who you are, kind of a costume in the theater of life? How much of what you do online would you want to reveal?
My name's Kendra. I'm calling from Tacoma, and I'm pretty sure that my online footprint screams crazy dog lady.
Hey, crazy dog lady. That's all right. You can call us anytime. The concern extends to Diego from Fort Lauderdale. For you, your online footprint leaves behind nothing good if I wanted to be a politician. Oh, come on. That's changing very quickly. And in Portland, Oregon, it's all about self-control. I avoid leaving any footprints online. No Facebook account. I expect the FBI and NSA are looking at everything I do online. Those paranoid folks in the Pacific Northwest. Love them. Have your say at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Follow us at Twitter, at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.